From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Kevin Beasley. This week, an opposition victory in Myanmar, why Syria's Kurds are reluctant to join the rebellion, and expanding the canal in Panama. Supporters of the opposition party in Myanmar, also known as Burma, are celebrating after its leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, and 43 other party members won seats in parliament. It's the first time in two decades that the National League for Democracy has participated in an election, and Suu Kyi's victory could help consolidate recent political reforms. It could also herald the end of foreign sanctions on a country that was ruled for half a century by a military junta. NPR's Anthony Kuhn followed Suu Kyi on the campaign trail and sent this report from Yangon.
The voice of a Buddhist monk reading morning prayers drifts out from his temple and across the fields at dawn. This is the rural township of Kaw Moo, which Aung San Suu Kyi hopes to represent in parliament. It's one of 44 constituencies at stake in this by-election. Farmer Tain U is riding his motorcycle to the local polling place. He says he plans to vote for Aung San Suu Kyi, but he doesn't think the election will change much in this poor and remote township, where most folks live in thatched bamboo huts without electricity or running water. I'm not hoping or expecting her to do anything for us, he says. I'm voting for her because I respect her. She's made great sacrifices for the people during nearly two decades under house arrest. Suu Kyi was released in late 2010. This followed general elections, which her party boycotted. It wasn't until last December that she decided to return to politics and stand for election. Chama Paze, we wish you good health, Suu Kyi's supporters cheered, mobbing her as she toured polling places around town. A defeat at the polls for Suu Kyi could have actually been a setback for the government, which knows that her cooperation is essential to getting foreign sanctions lifted. Observers believe that as a member of parliament, Suu Kyi could embolden fellow lawmakers to push for more reforms. Others are concerned about her ability to meet sky-high public expectations. She faces an uphill battle to accomplish ambitious goals, such as amending the constitution to limit the military's role in government. Suu Kyi mentioned this aim in a press briefing on Friday.
What the military will learn, I'm sure, is that the future of this country is their future, and that reform in this country means reform for them as well.
90-year-old Chan Tun is a former member of parliament and Burma's former ambassador to China and Canada. He points out that the military automatically gets a quarter of the seats in parliament, and whatever they may think, they have to vote as their commanding officers order them to.
The military has the power to take over at any time. Actually, most of the people in the army accept Da Su's ideas, but they don't dare to speak out in support of her.
There have also been concerns recently about 66-year-old Suu Kyi's health. She suspended campaigning ahead of the vote due to exhaustion. Dr. Tin Myo Win has been her personal physician for most of the past two decades. He says she's gotten through the grueling campaign by sheer force of will.
There's two parts, physical and spiritual. And her spiritual health is always 100%. But sometimes her physical cannot follow what the spiritual and the mind wants to do and everything.
Suu Kyi rises at 4:30 a.m. every morning for an hour of Buddhist meditation, Dr. Myo Win says, and she remains sharply focused on her goals without concern for herself. Suu Kyi says her goals transcend politics. She advocates a non-violent revolution of the spirit in the tradition of Mahatma Gandhi.
When I talk about a revolution of the spirit, I mean a revolution that will help our people to overcome fear, to overcome poverty, to overcome indifference, and to take the fate of their country into their own hands. An election alone is not going to change our country.
The official vote count will not be announced for several days. But Suu Kyi says her and her party's greatest victory in this election has already been achieved. and that is the rising political consciousness of Burmese citizens, particularly its young people. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Yangon.
Coming up, why Syria's Kurds are reluctant to join the rebellion and expanding the canal in Panama. Syria is a patchwork of ethnicities and religions, held together for 40 years by one family's rule. One of the ethnic groups, the Kurds, is an oppressed minority that makes up between 10 to 15% of the population. Opponents of the Syrian government hope the Kurds will join the uprising and help bring down the Assad regime. But as NPR's Kelly McEvers reports, it's not quite so simple.
Abu Azad is a Kurd who, until very recently, was living in Syria. His five children have never had Syrian citizenship. That's because of a decades-long policy in the country that discriminates against Kurds. When protesters began taking to the streets of Syria last year, Abu Azad, not his real name, joined them. He helped organize protests in Kurdish areas, calling for Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to step down. He recently found out he was wanted by authorities.
And they were chasing me. And they want to kill me.
Abu Azad and his family recently walked out of Syria and ended up here in Iraqi Kurdistan, where the Kurds of Iraq govern an autonomous zone that's grown stronger and more prosperous since the fall of Saddam Hussein. The trip took Abu Azad's family an entire night, fording streams and climbing mountains. We are against this regime, 100%, Abu Azad says. All Kurds are against this regime. But this is only part of the story for the Kurds of Syria. Most of them will tell you they're against a regime that for so long has withheld citizenship, forbidden them to speak or teach in their own language, and treated them like second-class citizens. But they're not all willing to fight to bring down that regime. This man, who goes by the name Abu Shiro, says he was a soldier in the Syrian army for a year until he escaped to Iraqi Kurdistan. He says he paid bribes to stay in his barracks rather than shoot unarmed protesters or arrest civilians and hand them to the dreaded security services. We ask him why he didn't join the growing group of defected soldiers known as the Free Syrian Army, who've launched an insurgency to bring down the Syrian regime. It's simple, he says, because I'm a Kurd.
Until now, we haven't any hope in Arabs to giving us our rights.
For that reason, he says, he doesn't want to die for nothing. It's a position that infuriates many in the Syrian opposition. If you're against the regime, the thinking goes, why not stay and fight, or at least stay and protest? The reason, says Abdul Hakim Bashar, who heads a Syrian Kurdish political party, is that predominantly Arab members of the Syrian opposition to this day refuse to reassure the Kurds that they'll have it better if the regime falls. At a recent meeting meant to unite the Syrian opposition, Kurds walked out after opposition leaders refused to promise the Kurds some special recognition in the new Syria. If this regime falls, Bashar says, and we don't have a clear program for how we'll get our rights, it could be worse than the regime itself. Bashar says U.S. and European diplomats have been pushing the Kurds to focus on bringing down the regime first and worry about the details later. But the Kurds don't totally trust the international community either, says Robert Lowe of the London School of Economics, who has co-edited a book about the Kurds of Syria. They believe they were abandoned when they rose up against the Syrian regime years ago.
Kurds have suffered before. They had their own uprising in 2004, and they suffered very badly for this.
What's more, says Lowe, there's the Turkey factor. Turkey has been supportive of Syrians who oppose their regime, but Turkey also for decades has repressed its own Kurdish minority.
The Kurds of Syria are very suspicious of Turkey and very hostile to Turkish involvement.
Lowe says any future action by Turkey, like arming the Syrian opposition or creating a so-called buffer zone where fighters could regroup, would be met by much hostility from the Kurds. So for now, until they know more about how their friends and enemies will act, the Kurds of Syria say they will wait and see. Kelly McEvers, NPR News.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Kevin Beasley. The Central American country of Panama is in the middle of one of the largest construction projects in the world right now, the expansion of the Panama Canal. The multi-billion dollar project will add a third channel to the waterway, equipped with far bigger locks than the ones built by American engineers almost 100 years ago. The expansion will allow massive cargo ships from Asia to pass through the canal and reach ports on the east coast of the United States. NPR's Jason Bobian reports.
At the Panama Canal, two giant ships are moving through parallel channels at the Miraflores locks, heading towards the Pacific Ocean. The orange and white Bow Summer is a tanker. The deck of the Ever Dynamic is stacked high with burgundy and blue shipping containers. More boats like these are backed up in both the Pacific and the Atlantic, waiting to enter the waterway. Arnold Cano, an engineer who's working on the expansion, says the basic structure of the facility hasn't changed since it opened in 1914, yet the volume of global trade has exploded.
Usually when people think about the expansion of the canal, most of the attention is given to the bigger ships, the post-Panamax ships. Right now they can't fit through the Panama Canal. And that's a big aspect of the expansion, but really the main driver for the expansion is capacity, is being able to transit more cargo.
By adding a third lane, 50% more ships will be able to pass through the waterway each day. But more importantly, the larger vessels will be moving significantly larger loads.
Right now, the biggest ship that can go through the canal is a ship that can carry about 4,000 to 4,500 20-feet containers. Containers come in different sizes, but 20 feet is the size that we standardize for measuring ships.
In the expanded canal, ships that can hold three times that many containers, 12 to 13,000 units, will for the first time be able to pass through the locks. These ships primarily shuttle goods from Asia to the United States. Rather than docking in California and sending their cargo by truck or rail to the East Coast, they'll be able to steam through the canal to Miami, Norfolk, or New York, although most ports on the U.S. East Coast still aren't deep enough for these vessels to enter. Work on the expansion of the Panama Canal began in 2007, and the new channel is scheduled to open in 2014. Currently, crews are working around the clock on both the Atlantic and the Pacific sides of the project. Massive yellow earth movers are cutting a valley-sized trench. Monster dump trucks, so large the driver's cabin looks ridiculously small, trudge through the ripped-up earth. Near the Pacific Ocean, concrete is being poured in what will eventually be lock number two.
This is one of the walls for the gates, that will hold the gates.
Ramon Cascante is standing on the floor of the project. He's an engineer in charge of water management, both keeping water out of the pit and making sure the contractors have the water they need on the site. Cranes loom overhead while workers rush in what seems to be every direction.
One of the most challenging things on this project is the durability requirement on the contract. We make clear on the contract documents that the locks need to last at least 100 years.
He says the contractors have had to formulate special concrete for the outer layers of the canal to withstand the constant flushing of water in and out. The new locks will have double doors so that one set can undergo maintenance while the canal remains operational. Shipping company officials say the opening of the new channel in 2014 will be a game changer for the global shipping business. Far more and far larger vessels will head to Panama even if they don't transit the canal. Even now, significant amounts of cargo are shipped to Panama's ports, reshuffled into smaller boats, and then distributed throughout the hemisphere. Taihan Zong, with China Shipping Lines in Panama City, says this will increase considerably as the canal becomes even more critical to global trade.
It looks like
He says boats that currently are going from South Asia through the Suez Canal to New York may instead head east and transit through Panama. The canal expansion opens up more opportunities, he says, to move more goods from China to the largest consumer market in the world, the U.S., at a lower cost. Jason Bobian, NPR News.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Beasley.